That is correct.
Last week, we got through guilty pleasures for watch movie, watch TV, and then listen. So now we've got read and then play slash do, like, you know, a game or a hobby we like to do. So we'll get started. Tom Hespos, why don't you drop on us what your guilty pleasure for reading might be?
I put this book not on the shelf of honor behind me, but on the shelf over there in the lower left.
Shelf of dishonor?
My kids cannot come across it because
this is the penthouse jokes.
This is a great book that somebody gave me. Well, anybody from the D&D crew understands like my sort of enthusiasm for the seedy underbellies of cities and my want to see, you know, more of that in the Star Wars universe and pretty much like everything else. But like,
yeah,
this is dealing with that in real life. And the book is called Etiquette for Outlaws. Get a load of the cover, folks.
Holy Moses.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even know who the authors are. Rob Cohen and David Wallach. I don't know, but like, basically, it's an instruction manual for the seedy underbellies of cities. So,
wow.
Like, how to behave yourself in a strip club.
What to tip a prostitute.
You know.
Oh, my God.
How to score drugs.
And the answer to that, of course, like, is just the tip.
All of that stuff, there's an instruction manual for it. And, I'm never going to do 90% of this book, but mm-hmm. I love knowing it for some reason.
I hope it's on Amazon.
Tom's like, I will never. Tom's like, I will never fail a streetwise role for the rest of my life.
Exactly. That's like, how much do you tip a tattoo artist? I don't know because I don't have any tattoos. But you know, if the situation ever arose,
you want to buy any of these books, get them on bookshop.org.
Yeah, support your local bookseller.
Indeed, mm-hmm. Indeed. So Tom, where did you get this tome of restricted knowledge?
You know what? It's funny. Like, I don't even remember. Who, I know it was a gift. Somebody gave it to me. I don't remember who it was. And
so you were blacked out. Okay, we get that.
It was probably your dealer.
Nobody knows where it came from.
Probably your dealer.
If I knew
right,
who
Tom?
It was, I would not tell you because it's that.
They tipped him.
And look at this book and just be like, uh-uh.
Was this? I'm presuming this book was a cash transaction?
You never give up your source.
You know, like I got it in, it was published in 2001, and I think I got it not too long thereafter. So
there are so many questions. There's so many questions, but okay. So I guess the first thing I want to know is, does it identify the publisher?
The publisher is Harper Entertainment, believe it or not.
Oh, come on. That's actually the worst possible answer, because now I'm wondering if that's like, if this information is really legit or not. All right. So, so my other question then is how do we know that outlaw etiquette from 2001 is still relevant in 2023?
Oh, it's not just relevant. It's prescient. Like the section on, you know, like how to deal with tranny hookers is fantastic. the advice, treat them with, you know, the gender that they're presenting as opposed to what they, you know, might actually be something, you know, that's good advice in 2023.
It is.
You know, like they got it exactly right. And they got that exactly right more than 20 years ahead of the fact. So
I'm ordering a copy for Ron DeSantis right now.
He doesn't need it.
You're presuming he can read, Mr. Swan. You're presuming a lot there.
Yeah, but hopefully the reporters will see it.
Yeah. It arrives in a brown paper bag.
You know, the book's a guilty pleasure because, again, I'm never going to do 90% of the stuff that's in this book.
You keep saying 90% and I keep not believing.
Yeah,
you.
I know. I want to know what the 10% is.
I want to know which 10. Yeah, exactly. That's my question. Yeah.
Tom,
you know, I'm never getting a tattoo.
We'll see.
You know, all right. You know, that's not
today.
Tattoos are mainstream these days. But
yeah, tattoos. I had a tip of tattoo. You just ask them what they get for a tip and they'll tell you. I mean, they're usually pretty open about it.
I'm probably never going to go to a fetish ball or a an orgy or anything.
You know, but it's good to be prepared.
And yeah, you know, like at least I know how to handle.
At
myself.
Least your eyes are wide shut.
Excited. I won't be. But
Tom, is this written? Is this written like serious? Is this written like tongue in cheek, or is this
no? You
know, this is like serious advice, or
where is the tongue?
Exactly tongue in cheek, yeah.
I can pick a passage at random if you like.
We've already got the explicit rating, so yeah, sure, knock yourself out, man.
The tongue is firm.
This episode will never see the light.
The lost episode. Chapter 45. Gun running.
This is the ET SoundCloud cartridge of episodes.
All right, I'll give you a choice. Do you want porn section or from the knives and guns section?
Oh, knives and guns.
Knives and guns. Yeah.
Because Chris will need to know this once he goes broke off the Cutler channel. So,
yeah. I've already gained you rookie pleasure.
You can see there's a section right there on swords.
Yes.
This is 0% chance.
We don't care how cool it looked in Highlander. Carrying a sword is way too 18th century for our team. If you must collect them, make sure they're actual swords and not that unsharpened fake Pier 1 crap. Perfect. I love it.
So the only thing I'm kind of curious about this, though, and yeah, right. And Chris Swan, I'd be curious to know your thoughts on this. Whether or not one actually intends to carry out any of these potentially, you know, like illicit activities, I would imagine, like, from a writing standpoint, if you're writing about like crime or thrillers or something like that, a book like this might be actually handy to have on hand just as like actually creative research, you know, like to without actually having to delve into the underworld oneself.
Oh, strikes me
as a helpful resource, right?
I love how you're creating the excuse for the copy you just ordered.
Yeah, basically you're helping him write it off as an expense on his tax.
Hey, look, you know what?
Bill is a good friend. Shut up, y'all. No one. It's like every writer. No one, especially anybody who writes crime, where I've literally had conversations with fellow writer. Like, you can't kill her like that. You can't put the body there. And then we look around in the coffee house and realize everybody around us is like, we're like, no. They're like, sure.
Yeah.
No one wants to look at my browser history.
It's okay.
No one wants to look at my, like, I hope.
Never do that. No, you've got to be like, what are you looking at?
Yeah, dude, that, you didn't hear nothing. Yeah.
You want a piece of this? You want to be next?
You're not ordering nearly enough lime for this. Come on, dude.
Tom, your choice reminds me of a book that I got 20 years ago called Getting Even, the complete book of dirty tricks. Hey Duke, yeah.
Oh yeah, we got the same section of the library.
Exactly. I was like, I would file those together.
I'm troubled.
I'm imagining Tom has his bookshelf, like it's like Harry Potter. There's this like arm, like this locked bar against the book, so you gotta like padlock it.
It's
and,
the
like,
restricted section.
Yeah, the restricted section, exactly. Like, no, man, like, no.
He solemnly swears he's up to no good. Yeah.
Just to reference that, Chris, like, there are a great number of internet forums where if you gave the advice to do anything in those Hey Duke books, you know, as revenge for, you know, a slight, you would get kicked off immediately. So it's best just to tell them to Google George Hey Duke.
Yeah.
Those books are full of spectacularly bad advice.
Did George Hey Duke ever produce his own version of the Anarchist Cookbook or not, or no?
It's not like that. It's kind of like
just like being a rat bastard kind of stuff.
Like rat effing people, like
got it. Okay. Shithousery, as we would call it.
I mean, like a glitter bomb would be like super tame for what's in those.
Man. Yeah. This is reminding me of the worst prank I ever saw in college, where somebody actually unscrewed the light fixture, like the light switch off somebody's, you know, dorm room, exposed the wires, inserted a jumbo prawn in between the wires, and put the whole thing back into the wall. So when they turned on the light, the electric current slowly cooked the shrimp inside this guy's wall for like weeks and weeks on end. And, you know, yeah. And it was it smelled like a Atlantean abattoir. It was absolutely terrible.
It's like an Upper Decker.
It's like, where's the smell? You can't tell. And it was awful. They finally pulled it out at the end of the year, and it was like carbon. The whole thing was really
an example of Hey Duke stuff. Like a relatively tame example would be to send a lot of porn catalogs addressed, you know, sign up for porn catalogs addressed to the, you know, head of your HOA who's happily married.
Right. You know, okay.
Stuff like that. But that's like really
not
really
like mainstream
tame.
Porn, but like Biggins, like you
right,
know, like
right.
you know,
yeah,
Biggins
specialty
and Daily
interests,
Legal,
we'll
stuff
say.
Like that.
Sure,
yeah.
Specialty.
All of that stuff up there, it's like the second half of the prank.
Three on two,
like,
you know, yeah. I mean, like
from the escalation, and then all the stuff in there that finish it, like, and just never have to deal with that person.
Outstanding. All right, so outlaw etiquette, very good. All right, so Chris Crenshaw, what's your guilty pleasure for reading?
Okay, so y'all. Back when I was in grad school, I was studying English, and I worked at Barnes & Noble during the day. I did a lot of restocking, and I had responsibility for the sci-fi and fantasy section, naturally. But everybody restocked general fiction. And one day I came across this mass market paperback called The Pearl. I flipped through it briefly just because I was like, huh. And I stopped. And I put it back on its cart, and I shelved it. I came back later because it was the damnedest thing I ever saw. The Pearl is it's actually the full 18-month run of a Victorian pornographic periodical.
Oh God, this isn't the Steinbeck? Okay, no, I got you.
That's what I was thinking. I was like,
for a second there.
And let me tell you, y'all, it is absolutely filthy. Yeah, there is nothing off limits. It's Rule 34 of the internet should have been Rule 1, because it was there for the Victorians too. Like, if you can imagine it, somebody's probably got it in here. It basically was a series of ongoing serial stories focusing on, you know, bondage or incest or bestiality. I don't know, whatever. But it was all interleavened with essays and poems. You know, naturally, every issue had a bunch of limericks, which is where I
read it for the poems. Yeah,
right, exactly, Tom. I read it for the poems. Like,
this is Lovecraft.
The limericks were kind of like my entry point, because they were funny.
Unfortunate choice of words,
but.
That's my entry point.
But they were also,
that's what she said,
just like inventive in a deeply ugly way. Like, it was, everything about it was just so like tawdry, and like I couldn't believe it, and it hooked me. So yeah, I'm guilty. I didn't like read it cover to cover, but I read a lot of poems.
Never got that far. You know,
first, two things about this. This thing cost £25 in like 1880 or whatever. And ooh, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a high price to pay for
porn. A lot of money. So, you know, Algernon Charles Swinburne, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He published two poems in this.
Outstanding.
In this, now, whether he agreed to publish them,
yeah,
is another question.
Gotcha. Were any of them about a man?
They are acknowledged.
So, Chris, my question for you is that, regardless of subject matter, I find anthologies of like old publications like this to be endlessly fascinating. Like Tom and I talk about, like, we do like data hoarding and we do deep dives on like archive.org and that sort of thing. Like, finding these like compendiums of just otherwise forgotten content, I find really compelling. Regardless if they, you know, if they're listed or not, but. My question to you about this one is that some of the content is the language, would that be considered filthy by modern standards, or is it just about like this, or is it just like the subject matter itself is so seamy?
It's both. A lot of the filthy language is dated.
Please, sir, can I have another?
You know,
yeah, right. That's kind of what I'm getting at, though. It's like, has some of the language dated itself to the point that what once was considered to be filthy and absolutely off limits is now, by today's standards, it's just normal parlance, and it just happens to be
now
talking
just,
about
no, it just sounds like an old person talking dirty. From a content standpoint, it's entirely modern. Like, there's no line between today and then, as far as I can tell.
Do you foresee a possible crossover publication between this and Outlaw Etiquette?
That would be perfect.
How to Tip a Victorian Prostitute.
Forward.
How many
farthings?
Wait, I have a question too. Like, so as an employee of Barnes & Noble, did you ever have the opportunity to do like recommendations by Chris?
How the fuck was this in Barnes & Noble?
No, I never did.
I have a question.
They never asked you to do that?
No, they did not want to personalize us that much.
Joe, to your point, Chris mentioned this to me.
In what Earth 616 is this in Barnes and Noble?
That's kind of the point.
That's it. Because like Chris was going to tell me, Chris told me before we started recording, he goes, here's my selection. It might land like a hand grenade. You let me know if it's okay. And I'm like, geez, I don't know about this one, Chris. This isn't out of bounds. He goes, yeah, because I got it when I was stocking at Barnes Noble. I'm like, then proceed.
Yeah, it is important, Joe, though, to notice that. Yeah, it was on the shelf at Barnes and Noble. It's, you know.
In what section?
I found it in the general fiction section.
This was in 1990.
You got this out of a trunk of a tree in the woods.
Four, I would say. And it was a mass market paperback.
It was a cheap
mass market paperback, but it has since been republished as a trade paperback. Now, in Australia, okay. I think it was around 2002, maybe. A dude who I guess worked for the government got found with a copy of this text on his computer. And was arrested and convicted of owning child pornography in particular, I think. But then when he appealed, like somebody
they're
was
all
like
120 now.
It's available everyone on is, Amazon. Everyone right now no, is no, turning their Kindle the fact version that, of this very second.
The fact that it was available on Amazon is what won him his appeal.
I'm looking at the entry for it on Amazon.
It was on the shelf
right,
at Barnes
right
and
now.
Noble.
You can buy it for $17 as a paperback on Amazon. The Pearl, a journal of facetive and voluptuous reading. That's a great title.
I know what we're all getting right? for Christmas now.
That's a pretty awesome title. Yes.
Y'all are family men, and that would be a horrible thing to do. Like, leave that around for one of your kids to discover. Good Lord. Dave Sedaris has a story about that.
Yes, he does. The Victorians were just so repressive. Go read Dracula. That's the most bonkers, sex repressed, nutty. Oh.
All right. So Chris, that was an excellent choice. Joe Pace, what is your guilty pleasure for reading?
I grew up reading voraciously Archie comics, and my kids love the stupid double digest Tales of Riverdale. And that's it. I misunderstood what high school would be like because of reading these when I was like 9-10 years old.
I don't see where you're going with that, Joe.
Reading this stuff in the late 80s, I thought I was going to grow up in the 50s, and I was mistaken. But I did learn
yeah,
that
sand kicked in my face by a guy at the beach with a flat top. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I did realize always pick the blonde. Because the rich brunette just doesn't respect you, and the blonde is gonna work hard. And you know, have a friend who doesn't like girls and you'll be fine.
Physiognomy should not be the lessons you learn here.
Man, I thought a letter jacket was gonna carry a lot more weight than it did. but I got to tell you, I loved these stories. And honestly, like I've gone back like a couple of years ago, my kids found the box of them and we're reading through these things and just devouring them. And I picked a couple up. They're still sneakily subversive, sneakily funny. Oh, yeah. As much as they were like, you know, written at a very banal level, there's some funny stuff in there. And there's a lot of ironic storytelling about male and female roles and just it's I'm sitting here defending Archie comics as literature, which, you know, come on, join in, feel free to either, you know, contest that interpretation.
Well, look, I mean,
there's a reason they remade it for cable.
Like 2 years ago, I went on a really deep dive and I read a ton of Archie comics, and I was just sort of blasting through. I went through a whole series of like Archie comics does a really good job of kind of self-curating, and it's constantly like producing like, you know, massive omnibuses of its own previous material. And so I read like, you know, the best of Archie, the best of Jughead, the best of Reggie, the best of Betty and Veronica, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I see what you're saying. It is hopelessly L7 though. I mean, it is so square. It's so square. And in its effort to offend absolutely no one, it does a pretty good job on that front. I mean, it really is as harmless as comics could possibly be. So I guess my question to you, Joe, is, but I mean, one can easily imagine while reading it, somebody passing by with a copy of, any other comic in hand, and sort of giving you like the Nelson Muntz point and laugh because you've got Archie in your hand. So have you ever been called out for reading Archie, or is it, have you just like lived with the secret shame that you like
well,
Archie
read them
and
in
one
public.
Day people would know?
No, I never read these in public. Two things. One quick thing. First of all,
there are two things I wouldn't read in public, Bill. Mein Kampf and Archie.
and the Pearl. But I will say that like the character of Veronica's father of Mr. Lodge, adore. I adore the complete ennui and weariness that guy has with all the bullshit that his daughter and her friends pull. He's a guy, he's got none of it. He's got no bandwidth for that at all. But one of my favorite stories in all of, and there are a lot of them that I enjoy, but one of my favorite stories is a lot of them that take place at the beach, and this nobody's getting sand kicked in their face, but there was like a contest in one of these beauty contests, and there's a lot of misogynistic stuff, right? Like there's a lot of oh look, there they are in their bathing suits and whatever, but this was one where they were doing a beauty contest, but it was based solely on their knees. So there was like this wall with one board removed, and they were judging based on the attractiveness of the knees of the contestants, and the girls are lining up and all that stuff. And of course, I think it's Archie is the judge, and he goes through and he picks, and it's Jughead's knees who wandered into the thing by mistake because he thought they were waiting in line for hot hamburgers or whatever. But like little things like that, that are so, there's a sneaky subversiveness to it where it's like, it takes that trope of, you know, objectification and turns it on its head by like, it plays with male female roles in ways that you wouldn't think would be possible. And yet it does.
One of the most, successful crossovers that Archie Comics ever got involved in was a pretty awesome comic they did back in the 90s, which was Archie Meets the Punisher. Archie and Marvel Comics Punisher come together.
Wow. I'm gonna kill that ginger. I'm gonna
it's basically there's this like really bad guy who's just a living doppelganger for Archie, who like takes off, and like the Punisher's hot on his heels, and the Punisher falls into Riverdale, and he crashes a prom, and it's like it's strangely bloodless, you know, because it is Punisher after all. But at the end, is it Miss Grundy, who's like she like totally gets the hots for Frank Castle,
as one does.
Nice.
It's just so bonkers. But it was a good comic.
Hey, wow. Man, fascists love fascists.
one of the things I do love too about it crosses over from Peanuts to Archie to some other things, where adults are completely disconnected from the lives of the kids, right? And the adults in Archie, whether it's the parents or the teachers, they all kind of watch what the kids are doing with this, I did the same thing, they're doing dumb stuff, it's fine, it'll all be fine. They're all very grounded, all of the adults, and they're all very patient with the antics of these kids. And they all view it through this lens of kids are going to be kids and do dumb stuff.
Yeah.
And I grew up with that. I'm reading that at 8, 9, 10 years old. And sometimes now when my kids are doing dumb stuff, I hearken back and I think about, this is the part where I'm not Archie. I'm Archie's dad watching the kids do their dumb stuff.
And a couple years ago, they rebooted Archie and Mark Waid was the writer, and they kind of redid it for a while. And I read that as well. That's actually a legitimately just like, it's funny by modern standards comic as well. It's just a really, the redo of Archie was just a delightful read. And I really loved it. And you didn't even need to read the old stuff, but I get what you're saying. Like it is square. It is kind of cringe to read it. And yet you understand why this has persisted for 80 years, something like that. I mean, Chris Sawn, what is your guilty pleasure for reading?
I was like 12 and I got the flu and I'm in bed for like 3 days throwing up. And this is early 80s. There's no personal computers cost like, you know, 10 grand in modern terms. We didn't have one, didn't yet have Atari. And I couldn't even go downstairs to watch Star Blazers, which is my favorite cartoon to watch after school because throwing up. So
good.
And I'm at that point where I'd read The Hobbit. I think I'd read Lord of the Rings. I'd read all my Hardy Boys and Three Investigators. I didn't want to reread them. And I was kind of like, I didn't have any other books to read. And I'm like, what? So I'm kind of in that cusp of, okay, I don't know what to do. And I'm whining. So my mom goes and buys this bag of used paperbacks and comes in, in here. And they're all spy thrillers, right? There's a Jack Higgins novel, which is its own embarrassing thing. not about Jack Higgins, just this particular book. And there are a couple of Alistair MacLean books, like Ice Station Zebra, which is still one of my favorite thrillers of all time. The Guns of Navarone and
Guns to the
his last book, Athabasca, which sucked. This book was at the bottom of the bag. I am relatively certain my mother did not read any of it, and I'm almost positive she didn't read the back cover. There's just no way that I should have gotten this.
Lady Chatterley's
at age 12. Sweet. No, it's called Shibumi.
Shibumi.
I'm going to read the back to you.
Yes.
Nikolai Hell, 1-0. Born in the ravages of World War I China to an aristocratic Russian mother and a mysterious German father. Raised in the spiritual gardens of a Japanese Go master, Hell survives the destruction of Hiroshima to emerge as the world's most artful lover and its most accomplished and highly paid assassin. Genius, mystic, master of language and culture, Hell's secret is his determination to attain a rare kind of personal excellence, a state of effortless perfection. Shibumi.
That is the most magnificent thing I've heard all year. Please continue. You sold it so well. It had to be the end. I'm sorry. Go on.
Now living in an isolated mountain fortress with his magnificent Eurasian mistress. Hell faces his most sinister enemy, a super monolith of espionage and monopoly. The battle lines are drawn. Ruthless power and corruption on one side, and on the other, Shibumi.
I gotta find this book.
From now on, Shibumi is our shibboleth. Like Shibumi is
Shibumi.
Whenever we need to like have like a password to get into like Shibumi.
Oh my gosh.
The new John Wick movie is coming out. I had not seen any of them before. So yeah. I was like, I've got to watch the first. So I pulled up John Wick.
Yeah.
Security guard in the movie is reading this book.
Reading that book, that's hilarious. I didn't know that.
I don't know if this is a spy thriller, if it is a meta spy thriller, as it's been called before. There's a guy named Inverarity who has a blog and he writes all these book reviews, and he did a book review of this in like 2012. I took some stuff off of. Or if it's a send-up of both spy thrillers and the people who read them.
Shibumi.
The same guy, Trevanian, is a pseudonym. He wrote The Eiger Sanction. It was meant to be a parody of spy thrillers. Hollywood so didn't get that it was a parody that they made a movie out of it starring Clint Eastwood. So the author got annoyed and wrote another one called The Lou Sanction. And then he was close with
Richard Chamberlain.
Yeah.
It's okay. There's a CIA plot to assassinate Jewish commandos at the behest of the PLO.
Stop.
There's a super secret organization called Mother Company, which is basically every energy corporation on the planet that basically secretly runs the Western world.
Whoa.
There's esoteric descriptions of sex. There's dollops of Eastern philosophy. There's scenes from pre and post World War II Asia. The misty, rugged mountains of the Basque Country, evil machinations, well-drawn characters, outrageous plot twists, flamboyant prose, and spelunking. Like detailed.
This is like if James Clavell wrote a Mac Bolan novel.
Well, that's what I said.
That's almost exactly what it's like.
Oh,
and yet,
I'm so in.
This guy Hell, he's what did the reviewer call us? Said this is
the world's finest lover.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
I've already got him cast in the movie. Have you guys seen Bullet Train?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Michael Shannon's Russian warlord at the end, that's Hell, right? So we just gotta copy paste that into Shibumi and
another John, the guy who directed the John Wick flicks.
Yeah.
He optioned this to direct it.
Stop it.
Nice.
Literally, I am no lie. Okay, he's this white Russian aristocrat who has grown up with the ancient secrets of the Orient, right?
Chris is coming from a place of having read this. Okay.
So I've read this three times. He's in my life.
You know what I'm saying? Like Chris is a subject on the beach
every goddamn summer.
He teaches this to his ninth graders.
Seriously.
He hates the West. this book is deeply like every American and it's bad, which made sense. It came out in 1979. It's like post Watergate. Like
I was going to ask when it came out.
It's Crenshaw's Bible.
But as a 12 or 13 year old, when I finally read it, I was like, wow, like they're all bad. Cause usually there's like some bad corrupt ones. None of the good guys. No, they're not all bad. Hell's not this all, mystic
hashtag
dude.
Not all Westerners.
He has attained Shibumi and then he lost it because he's mad at the Westerners because he was living in Japan and they showed up and bombed Japan, which really hurt all his friends because they were all just innocently playing Go until the Americans showed up. So now he's like going to go kick ass. Along the way, he becomes this master of naked kill, which basically means he can use any household object to kill you with, including like a comb or a paper cup, a pencil. That whole thing about John Wick and the pencil. Taken from this book. Literally. He leaves Japan because it's become too westernized. The white dude is too Japanese for the Japanese. So he leaves in a huff. He goes to the Basque countryside. Of course, they all love him. He becomes an honorary member of the Basque people. Along the way, he becomes the most Hollywood assassin. And is the only Westerner to achieve stage 4 lovemaking, which, yes, gets described in detail in the book.
That's
and it's clinical
Frank
as opposed to pornographic.
Right,
otherwise known as Shibumi.
Yeah.
Stage 4 lovemaking.
Stage 4.
He brings he's having sex with this young woman, consensual, is bringing her to her fourth orgasm, where she's basically screaming, I'm going to die, don't. And then she's like in great
this
pleasure.
This is Sting, right? This is Sting.
The next line is, hell, having no particular desire to climax himself, let her down easily. You're like, come on, man.
Oh, I mean, man.
He's in prison at one point. And he loses Shibumi, but he gains a proximity sense.
You've lost your mojo.
So he's basically Daredevil.
Man. This is sublime.
But at the same time, there are passages in here where you're like, this description is almost of some things is almost like literary in terms of its language.
Yeah.
Okay. They make fun of action stories with lots of violence and a mass market paperback. That was like an airport book. That's about violence. And like it's about, he's writing about the stuff that he's making fun of. And he made a ton of money and it's a hot, glorious mess of like, You want to read it on a basic level. It's this really dated 70s look with racist and gender tropes.
Yeah, no, I can't.
It's
okay because the publishers are working on fixing all of that. And
yeah,
soon
I know.
You'll be able to read Shibumi.
It's from Ballantine. I mean, it's like
Could you imagine the sensitivity reader for Shibumi?
They're
quick. I need to attain Shibumi to be able to Shibumi.
They're at like a stage 4 level of quitting.
No, the people that do this book will already have done Anne Rice's stuff. They'll be fine.
Yeah,
they've already redacted the entirety of the Fountainhead. They're good.
It's
outstanding.
You can't tell. Like it's a critique of itself.
Yeah,
and it's a whole lot of fun.
So did Trevanian, given that Shibumi was a big success, right? Did Trevanian ever like follow it up with another Shibumi like novel? Or was this like his swan song?
He wrote other books. And he died in the early 2000s.
Shame.
He was real reclusive. You can look him up and see a whole list of books he wrote. Again, Iger sanctioned, Lou sanctioned, this one. Then he started writing books under another name. I don't have my list here, but what those are. But Don Winslow, who's a crime writer right now, he wrote The Power of the Dog and The Cartel and The Border, I think, is basically about drug wars. He wrote a book, I think it was called Satori, which is apparently a prequel to this. It was hell when he's like younger. And you learn about him as a kid, but there's a bunch of missing years, and suddenly he's the world's most accomplished lover, the most dangerous assassin.
I'm
funny enough, he grew up, he went to Riverdale High.
Yeah. No,
I want to read that with a stomach flu.
Yeah, I have got to get my hands on this book.
I was like, there's no way in hell my mom, I read it. I read it first because the cover was like, there's no picture. It's kind of boring.
Yeah. It was in the bottom of the bag for a reason. They're trying to,
And I picked, so first I probably one read in. It probably a year later. Was like, wow.
That's good stuff, Chris. That's outstanding. So my guilty pleasure is Playboy magazine, which at one point in time, I honest to God was reading for the articles.
Don't
and
read
it's
it
like
the pictures.
I knew saying this like I was going to get beaten up, but like, here's a story is that in 1992, I'm in college, I'm doing writing and that sort of thing. And I had caught wind there was a Playboy college fiction contest with like a $3,000 prize. I'm like, this is like a big deal. I'm like, and actually like a professor was like, yeah, you know, actually I had a short story. He's like, you should probably submit this. I'm like, it's science fiction. Are you sure? He goes, no, give it a try. So I submitted it. But then I was like, all right. And I think before I submitted, I'm like, I need to like, because I remember I'd always heard like, read Playboy for the articles, yuck, 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 yuck. But then I was like, but then I would hear like, no, like, it's like, you know, I heard like, no, they actually produce like really fantastic fiction in this magazine. You should check it out. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I was in college with a bunch of fraternity guys. So copies of Playboy were plentiful, right? So I grabbed whatever issue that is.
Carpeted our rooms with them.
Yeah, practically. So I got my hands.
Alas, knowingly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got my hands on
the pages open and read the articles.
Well, here's the thing. I remember the issue was November 1992. And the reason why I remember it is because
Elle McPherson was in it. What?
No, well, it was an interview with Sir Patrick Stewart, right? Right when Star Trek The Next Generation was a big deal. I'm like, right? And I was like, whoa. I was like, just an interview with Patrick Stewart. Wait a minute. So I stopped and I read the interview. And actually, I was mesmerized by how good the interview was. And I was like, this is astonishing. And that's when that mm-hmm. kind of introduced me to the Playboy interview. And that interview was actually really formative to me as a journalist because I love doing interviews. And actually, I never tell anybody this, but like there are two like interviews I think of in my head when I do interview stories. One is the classic Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, which is the anti-interview, which is like Frank Sinatra can't be talked to. So they talk to everybody who knows him, who's in Vegas at the time. And they create this like weird outline of Frank Sinatra based on everything but Frank, right? And you get this like negative image of him, like photograph negative image. I mean, but then the other one is this Patrick Stewart interview. By God, they're right. Playboy actually produces some really good prose. And so I went through this period where I was like reading Playboy for the articles, and people were like, what are you doing, Coffin? I'm like reading it for the articles. Fuck off, you know. And I was like aggressive about it. But then I was like once like my own like, kind of arrogance over it sort of wore off, I'm like, I can't get away with this. This is like, I can't be that guy who reads the articles. Eventually,
I gotta
like,
get off this bus.
You're not Gordon.
I gotta get off this bus before
get me off this train.
Before I get terribly injured. Exactly. You know, it did encourage me to actually, you know, to apply for the college fishing contest. I didn't win, but I did get shortlisted for it. And in my box of literary memorabilia, one of my most prized possessions is the hand-addressed rejection letter from Playboy magazine going, you didn't win, but here's what we liked about your short story and sort of thing. And it was this little, on this little corner, I still have it. And it's like I would frame it if it weren't for Playboy, right? You know, because people would be like, what's going on, Bill?
No, but at the same time, what a great conversation.
It's really, I know, but it's one of those.
I would put that on my desk.
So we got together at Joe's house last summer up on the lake, and Tom brought the book of Playboy interviews. And I remember I was reading through it. And I'm like, yeah, I wasn't in some sort of fugue state in college. They really are as good as I remember them. And they're astonishingly good. I mean, Tom, you can tell me their are awesome.
Like, all right. Just so we get the origin story here. I was a media planner at Young and Rubicam in 1994 and took my first meeting with Playboy magazine. Now I was working on the US Army account. Was there a prayer that the U.S. Army was ever going to advertise in Playboy? No.
They should have.
Did we take the meeting anyway? Yes. And they gave me multiple copies of the Playboy interview. And I was like, what am I going to do with this thing? Like,
read them.
None of the people in the group wanted theirs. So they gave all theirs to me. And I had multiple copies of it. I started reading it. And I'm like, oh, my God, these are great. And look who they were able to get. I mean,
I know.
Just in this book, it's like, you know, all right, you got Ayn Rand, you have Jimmy Carter, Marlon Brando, Pete Rose, Oliver Stone. It's like it's like a who's who of like anybody who is doing anything like that, top of their game, you know. I loved it.
It's good stuff. So but my reading, you know, moment of shame is the fact that I did in fact read Playboy for the articles, and I know how bad that sounds. So
I can barely remember. I barely remember those naked women.
I do love Bill's capacity to pivot from this is shame to this is really me being like cooler. anybody thinks, because I will say this.
Bill has a smoking jacket, yes.
Right? Exactly. He's basically Christopher Walken on SNL. But
Not true at all.
There are two things for me, like from my Playboy reading days. Like one was there was a short story called The Last Man of Letters. And there was an aging sophist author who was on his last legs and dying, who I think was the germ of Isaiah Moss. Stays with me. This is from like the late 80s, early 90s, which stayed with me and was proud. And then there was a short story, and it was like one of those one page jobs. And it was a kid who was masturbating in his bed, and his mother came in, caught him doing it, but instead of saying anything or doing anything, she like took her shirt off and like showed him her boobs and like, but like it was this beautifully written scene. It was it was erotic and whatever else, but it was like the literature was unbelievable. And I'm sitting there going, like, the content is titillating and whatever else, and yet the quality of the craft is next level. And to Bill, to your point, is like how, in this the framing of this stuff that is, you know, we're inculcated to see as terrible, and yet there's a lot of beauty in the work.
When I was starting to write, like writing short fiction and trying to send it out to places, like, please publish me. You get a novel and short story writer's market every year, and you look through it, and Playboy and Penthouse, especially Playboy, were like, they were one of the top, they would pay $1,000 or more. For a story. I was like, are you serious? And so, I found some of the article. I was like, this is good journalism. Yeah. I mean, this is good writing. And thought, I never got published in, but I mean, I was like, Richard Ford would get published in Playboy. Tom Jones, they weren't publishing me, but.
So anyway.
But no, it was basically like awesome. The New Yorker with nudie pics.
Yeah. I mean, that level of like, that always seems like once upon a time market.
Once upon a time. So it's kind of hard to imagine it really, but it was that thing. So I don't know. All right. Moving on to the next chapter, this sordid tale, Tom, what's your guilty pleasure for play, hobby, do for activities?
You already told everybody what it was. Data hoarding.
Yes, data hoarding.
I love going out to the Internet Archive, using their command line query tool, which, is its own class of nerddom, to, download old pulps, old magazines, pretty much anything that they have that I don't want to see disappear. I back up on a giant server here because... I feel like I'll probably read it one day. Not right now, but I will read it one day. And that in and of itself, that's the thing behind data hoarding. It's like, it's like hoarders, except digital. So, you get to take a lot of crap from people for, are you actually reading any of this stuff that you're downloading? Or, but like, you feel this unbelievable kind of like, you have to go and get this and give it another place to live, because it may all go away one day, and you won't have, these scans of 1920s pulp magazines or, stuff that just like, if it disappears, it disappears forever. So it's a guilty pleasure of mine to, occasionally when I have a day off, go into the Internet Archive and see what else they got.
The Internet Archive should be protected at all costs. I mean, there is so much good stuff in there.
You're basically like the Voyager satellite, or, the Voyager probe with like
Beecher.
Right? Like all of the human, the blues artists who are long dead, and yet their music is leaving the solar system. Like that's you.
Less chance of destroying the Earth, though.
Yeah.
Well, that's a risk we all take.
See, I was gonna make some sort of Library of Alexandria reference, and y'all are going with Star Trek the Motion.
Shibumi, Chris, shut up.
you have definitely achieved that level of perfection, Grasshopper. I'm still working in stage three.
Look, I'd be lying
if
I said when this
stage four podcaster, get out of here.
Look, when this podcast episode is done, the first thing I'm going to do is run to archive.org and see if I can find Shibumi. Okay, I know it's there somewhere, I need to have a copy of it because I've heard about it. Tom, I am so with you on the data hoarding, man. I get it. And yes, people are like, why do you have a full terabyte of stuff that you're never going to read if you need to live to 10,000?
It's like, the same. It's the same explanation as my Steam library.
Yeah.
Like, why not?
That's accurate.
Exactly. I might play that one day.
Exactly. It's better to have it and not read it than for it to be completely lost to somebody, you know. The thing with data hoarding is it does speak to this notion that we imagine, well, all content of all kinds is being saved somewhere. Somebody has a copy of it. And that kind of thing, that's really not true. I mean, like, a lot of stuff does fall through the cracks and it does get lost, especially older stuff, like stuff like, you know, that was published, you know, decades ago. And like having these things archived, it's a great thing to have, you know. And it's like a good example was Tom, you and I were talking about the Strand magazine, right? Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, so we went to archive to pull. We were like, we're gonna pull together our own personal collection of the Strand, just so we have it, you know. And it took some doing to pull it together. Like it was there, but it wasn't just like, oh, click a button, you've got every issue of the Strand. Like, and this is the Strand. This is a publication of like no small renown. And it took a little bit of effort for us to actually scour the web and figure out where it was and to put it all together and to index it all. And that's just one rather prominent publication. There's a lot of ephemera out there that, you know, you could argue deserves to be lost, but it really doesn't. It belongs in a museum, right? So
yeah, well, you know, you're it doesn't belong in a museum, it belongs in a library.
Yeah.
What you're describing is the same impulse that gives us public libraries.
But yeah, I mean, it is that kind of you know, the same impulse. I agree with you, Chris. You know, like it doesn't help. Like, I collect also like physical editions of certain, you know, old pulp magazines, and you know, they call them pulp for a reason. They're not exactly printed on the best quality paper.
Some of these
things, like if you open them up to read them, they just fall apart. You know,
it's before the acid-free paper
of this stuff, and you know. Even if I never read it, you know, you have some of the, you know, like Weird Tales or something like that. You have a lot of very respected old authors from, you know, Lovecraft to, you know, all the Ray Bradbury and, you know, all these guys published in that magazine. And, you know, they're not going to be physical copies forever. And you know, even the digital archives are incomplete. So, like, let's pull together what we can get, and you know, even if we never read it, we preserve it for posterity, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. Chris Crenshaw, what's your guilty pleasure for activities here?
When I play video games, especially now that I'm an adult and I can afford to buy a new game every now and again, I don't play on hard anymore, almost never. and I feel bad about that, like I'm cheating myself. I don't know.
So, Chris, hang on.
It used to be that you had to keep playing the same game forever, so you'd escalate the difficulty level. Now, you know, when I start a new game of Alpha Centauri, I've been playing that game for 20 years, and I still shrug and put it on, like, you know, like level 3 of 7.
The radio button, dipshit mode. Yes.
Chris, it's fine. I still play Civilization 4 on, like, you know, chieftain level. It's fine. It's okay.
I feel bad about it, but not that bad, I guess.
You know what? I got nuked on Reddit a while back because there's a game I've been playing a lot called Noita, which is this cool indie game. It's like a side scrolling game where you're like this little wizard going down through these endless levels of caves and whatnot. And it's known because it's really, really hard, right? And you get killed easily. It's like a permadeath game. But it's got a big modding community. And so, you know, I was playing it and I figured all these, you know, quality of life mods that made the game significantly easier, you know? And I'm like, hey, I'm enjoying it. And I made the mistake of like letting that slip in the r/Noita subreddit. And people were like, heretic, and I got downvoted so bad for it. Yeah, so I get where you're coming from, Chris. Like it hurt. I'm like, I'm just having fun. I'm 50 plus years old. My reflexes aren't what they used to be. And like, shut up, old man.
I have to use an access keyboard.
Exactly. I turn my computer on with my long extendo claw. Leave me alone, you know.
I'm with you though, Chris. I've been playing games of Age of Empires 2 on Steam, and the difficulty level never goes higher than moderate, because all right, I'm gonna spank, the Mongolians as the Vikings or whatever, but I'm gonna enjoy the spanking the entire time. I know I could play it on hard, or
You're not looking for a challenge. You're looking for a diversion.
Yes,
it's fun.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
the need is different.
That's fair, Chris. Fair.
Huh. That's not a. That's not a judgment or anything. It's just sort of like, I don't need to be like, let's see if I can kick. It's like, I probably can't, and I don't really want to expend the energy to try. I just want to I want to go crush the Mongols. Gotcha.
That's why I so seldom play online.
Leave no traces.
Playing against real human beings. I got shit in the AI I could exploit. Yeah.
Don't let them know.
Although that's dead. I did laugh really hard at Endgame watching, Fat Thor and Korg playing, was it Fortnite? Screaming at the...
Here he is again.
Here he is again.
To the point where my kids were like, Dad, shut up. I'm like, it's just funny. Like, just what? They're like, God, you're embarrassing me. I'm like, yes.
That's what I'm here to do.
That's my job.
Achievement unlocked.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So that's really good. Yeah, no, but Chris, I hear you though. Like, I haven't, and actually my son gives me a lot of crap for it, because I'll play games like on easy mode, or I just don't have the interest to get good, at these things. Because it's like, dude, I don't have 150 hours a week to dedicate to getting great at this game, because I actually have a lot of other things to do, and I have a small amount of time to play, so I need to enjoy it rather than
this
grind
is why
my
I've
teeth.
Never played a Dark Souls game,
dude, right? and I've been told Dark Souls is fantastic. I'm like, if you enjoy pain, there's no way at my age I'm gonna play Dark Souls and enjoy it, because it's not just a matter of I don't have the time any given day to dedicate to it. It's like, I don't have the frequency to go back again and again and actually increase the skills I need. Like, it's going to be my first day every day, every time I play the game.
You nail that, which is that for us, the on-ramp for learning a new game, a new skill is so steep. Yeah. We're better off going back to the games we know, going back to Alpha Centauri, going back to Sifor, going back to Age, whatever it is. And just dominating something we're already comfortable with.
Yeah.
Welcome to 50, right? 50 is basically saying, what am I already kind of good at? And let me just marinate in that, quasi expertise versus trying to learn a new skill. No, ain't nobody got time for that.
This Pac-Man is the last video game that mattered.
Dude, you know what? I don't want to jump in line. I have things to say about this, but I'll wait till my turn.
Two, so. I'm here for you.
You got to go back to Mario and I know the story that Bill's going to tell, but
No, you don't.
I'm in the same boat. My kids, they'll build a box around me in Fortnite and shoot me from the top. And I'm like, all right, very funny, but I will spank the crap out of you at Mario Kart. Because I played that high for about 10 years and
come play some Madden with me.
That is muscle memory you do not forget.
You do not forget, exactly.
Don't mess with what a man mastered in his 20s. Don't do it.
Blue shell you at the finish line just for fun, just to watch your face.
Exactly.
My kids are like, let's play FIFA and smoke your ass. I'm like, that's great. Let's play Warlords and I'll kill all of you.
Yes. Right,
like, if they want to play FIFA,
what is that? I'm like, watch.
An education, son. Joe, what's your guilty pleasure for this chapter?
As a youngster, I was classically trained in tap, jazz, and ballet. And later in college, I studied ballroom dance. And my first wife and I competed and won tournaments, won contests in ballroom dance down outside of Boston. And so I still enjoy dance. It's something I enjoy. It's something I love. There it is. Have at it.
No, man, you see a couple dancing at a party and they know what they're doing.
The bride and groom is one of my favorite things to do at a wedding reception.
Are doing some three moves you've got, bring it on sex thing people like Kathy and I have two moves we can shag, and we have two moves that people are like, woo! I'm like, we're not good, we're fine. But people are like, that's awesome. I'm like, no. And then when people really know what they're doing,
Bring the Lindy, bring the sliding doors, all of the rest. Yeah.
Look, people like watching middle-aged white men having a good time. We're all a little goofy. It's just fun.
Yeah.
Man, I would love to have had that skill. Like, you know, when you hit that point in your 30s where you're just sick and tired of going to weddings, like, boy, I really would have loved to have had that skill right then, man. Oh, man. Show up the bride and the groom. Never invite us ever again.
Find the hottest bride. Find the hottest bridesmaid. And you're like, you come here. Let's go. Let's go to the dance floor.
My first wife and I studied together, and we had a whole thing. And then, like, you know, we split up. And then when Sarah and I started dating, I'm like, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to teach you how to dance, because when we go to weddings, here's how it's going to roll.
I'm going to dance. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, I'd rather it be with you than with whoever else is out there. So I taught her, and then, you know, we were able to go from there. But to this day, we'll go to fundraisers or, you know, galas for nonprofits or whatever. And we do our thing, you know, and people are like, oh my God, you guys are so the dirty secret about dancing is that it's like a lot of other things. A little bit of expertise goes a long way. You know what I mean? Like, if you, and Chris, this is to your point, if you kind of know what you're doing, you really look like you know what you're doing.
Yes.
The distance between not knowing what you're doing and a little bit is just as wide as the distance between a little bit and a whole lot.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, to go from a little bit to a whole lot is 10,000 hours. You know,
I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to know enough to make you look like a doof.
But, you know, Joe, dancing in public and really kind of like, you know, commanding the scene and all that, it always struck me as a little skill is important, but confidence seems like it's a massive thing. Like, I've seen
people, you also have to be like brutally handsome.
Well, your roguish good looks are, you know, I mean, are a thing of legends. We all know this, but apart from that, right? You know, adjusting for that, you know, that sort of thing. But I've seen people who I thought were terrible dancers, but they were so into it and they're so committed that people are like just flocking to them, like, yes, you're the coolest thing ever. And it's always struck me as sorcery. Like, it's kind of amazing. Like, if you have, I guess, the skill to be confident, then all sorts of achievements unlock on the dance floor, right? Like, how much of a guilty pleasure is this really? Because it seems like you totally enjoy it. There's nothing really, you know, I mean, do you have a history of people coming after you?
You're just cataloging how you're a square, not why you're guilty.
Okay, you really want, do you want the guilty part? Because I'll drop it.
Yes, like, no, let's unburden here. Come on.
I started this when I was fifth, sixth grade. I started doing, you know, the tap, jazz, ballet classes. And I remember in sixth grade, my dance school did a routine. And it was, I remember to this day, Gloria Estefan, "The Music Is Gonna Get You," right? Like that whole bit, Miami Sound Machine. Mm-hmm. And I had this black outfit that had red and white sequins on it. I was in a class of, like, I don't know, 15, 20. I was the only guy. And so the teacher had to feature me as, like, the guy. And they're like, what, was going to put me on the end? Like, no, like, put you in the middle and the girl around you and all this stuff. I was so convinced that what I was doing was art that I felt the need to share it with my sixth grade class. Now, looking back on it, 12 years old.
Now we get to it.
I did my performance for the 40 kids of my sixth grade class, which all of which explains why I still to this day haven't lost my virginity.
Now we're getting to it.
This was next level. Like, I did it. I didn't just kind of half do it. I did this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get
full
it.
Full on.
and then, like, the next day you realize you have to change schools.
Yeah. The next day I realized maybe that wasn't quite the moment I had hoped. Like, remember, you got to remember, this is 20 years before Napoleon Dynamite. Like, nobody was voting for Pedro. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, there's no irony to this. It's simply just,
this,
you
know, was just Joe and his tap shoes and his sequins.
And the cruelty of 12-year-olds. I mean, yeah, in
1988 boundless. Or whatever the hell it was, 1987. Yeah. Like, yeah.
This is also when Joe learned how to fight, by the way.
It's also when Joe leaned back and said, maybe I'll just be smarter than you guys. Forget being cooler. Like, that's not going to happen. That ship is sailed.
Sue.
That's outstanding. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, everybody's pointing and laughing until somebody's on the dance floor crushing it. And then, like, everybody comes out and they want to dance with you. And all of a sudden, you're the idiot on the sidelines. You can't dance and you feel like a dope because you're like, well, I wish I could dance and be out there.
Phil Collins had a song about that.
Yeah, songs about lots of things. Well, although it is it is strangely appropriate to bring up Phil Collins during the Guilty Pleasures episode, but we'll just leave
stop
it.
Sorry.
All right.
Studio.
Chris Swan, what do you bring into this chapter of Guilty Pleasures?
Before the pandemic, on Facebook, which I know old book now, but I would keep seeing these clips from the Graham Norton show.
Yes.
Which is this, which, you know, is in the UK, and it's a chat show, but they drink and it's on the BBC. So there's, you can kind of say whatever you want.
And they get A-list talent.
Oh, yeah, and it's really A-list talent. Yeah. And it was just, I would see the, I'm like, oh, this is really funny watching. I think they had Tom Hiddleston on once with Robert De Niro on the other end of the couch. And Graham Norton, who's this, he's friendly and all, he's slightly flamboyant and just a little revved up and makes jokes with all of them. He asked Tom Hiddleston, because you do impressions, don't you? And you see Hiddleston's like, yeah, I do. And he's looking slightly flustered. And he says, I would like, his first impression was of when he was in, what was the movie with Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen film. And he was Owen Wilson. He was doing an impersonation of him. And it was sort of fun to do. And he's done all of his fellow Avengers, he said. And Graham Norton says, I only ask. And Hiddleston turns beet red. He's like, because I understand you do a very good impersonation of Robert De Niro. And Hiddleston's his goofy earnestness, like looking at De Niro, who he hadn't met until right then, who's looking at him like, okay, so what the f- are you gonna do?
Yeah.
And the host and the guests in between them are like, what are they gonna do? And he does this, he does it from Heat. This whole scene, the diner scene from Heat. And he does Pacino just as well as he does De Niro.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is so meta that we're doing this right. And it sounds good, but I was like, oh, this is kind of funny. Then the pandemic hit, right? And I'd seen several of these clips. So we're all locked at home, locked down. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't write anything. I think part of it was for like about 2 months, it was just sort of like, are we all going to die? So that fight or flight thing. And it's funny. And, you know, I would even laugh about it then. It's sort of funny to laugh about it now, but I was also like, I had a hard time reading. I just couldn't concentrate anything. So I was just like channel surfing because you're stuck at home. And so I went back and started watching these Graham Norton clips, and it's weird. Being a 53-year-old man going, I'm like watching clips from this chat show in the UK, watching all these famous people who I don't know. And I'm not really pretending they're my friends, but why not? But listening to their story, and they were funny and they're self-deprecating.
Chris, did you see the one where Hiddleston on Graham Norton can't pronounce penguin? From the
that's a Cumberbatch.
That's been a Cumberbatch. I'm sorry.
He's like, they're... And you hear this voiceover. Yeah, he's doing these. He goes penguin, and then he can't get it right. He loses. As he says, "I lose."
He's
all
doing
sense
like this. He's
order.
Narrating that like wildlife show, and Graham Norton brings it up. He's like, "So apparently, I'm supposed to ask you to say penguin," and like Cumberbatch
and he
dies.
Went, right? Penguin, and he goes, "I'm sweating right now."
Penguin.
And he goes, "Say it." And he goes,
"Penguin." Like he can't
penguin.
Get it right throughout the whole show.
Right, but he kept going penguin, penguin,
penguin, like, penguin.
Couldn't.
Oh my god, it's. And it's a train wreck, the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like a published show, some like Nova or whatever it is.
Oh yeah,
and it's
like
a train wreck of Cumberbatch
not being
able to say penguin.
This is, there is an entire team of experts who are paid by you, the British taxpayer, to oversee this, and none of them like interrupt them in the booth and say start over or no, you got it wrong. They're just like, let's just watch.
Excuse me, Doctor Strange. That's not how you say penguin.
Right, and. You know, Sir Patrick Stewart tells a story about, you know, being circumcised or not and being confused as to whether he is, to Hugh Jackman, who's dying of like laughter. And it's really odd, but it was comforting to go back and watch these things. And I still do that every once in a while. It's just, I don't even know if that qualifies as a hobby. Oh, not really. It's not like I'm cataloging all these. Like, oh, let's look at this.
There's 30 seasons of that show. How many did you
watch? It's gone for freaking ever.
Yeah,
it's gone for eternity. Did you see the one where Emma Thompson is talking about how she has the creek out behind her house and she would go naked?
Yeah.
She would go out and bathe naked out in the stream out behind her house.
It's the call. There's some old man, naked old man running around.
And she went back to her house and got a knock on the door, and it was the cops. And they were like, excuse me, we had reports of a naked old man out behind your house. And she said, apparently, I've gotten to the age where my breasts look like testicles.
And Emma Thompson could care less. She has no problem.
Yeah.
But that's what I think about the whole Graham Norton thing.
Norton.
Is that, like, you don't get the Jimmy Kimmel, the Jimmy Fallon. You don't get like the prepackaged,
there's a vulnerability to it
stuff. You get actual insights and funny stories about these people. I've seen them too. I love when they come up on my Facebook reels or whatever, and I'll watch them and
go back, watch Matt Damon, Bill Murray and Hugh Bonneville from Downton Abbey showing up drunk. They're already drunk being interviewed. And making fun of it. And Matt Damon says, this is the best talk show I have ever been on. Hands down. Like, and you're like, they're not playing, man.
They're hammered.
It's fun.
It's good stuff.
Damn. So that was a passable Matt Damon, man.
Yeah, right? It was wasn't bad.
Say, how do you like them apples?
He's already aged 40 years.
Like Christ. At the end of Private That's Ryan. Jason Bourne. Yeah. Anyway, all right. So my guilty pleasure for this round is one I've gone back and forth on a lot, because I've been trying to like really sort of own up to some seriously cringy stuff in my behavior in this episode. So I have to follow through, and it gets back to what we're talking a couple moments ago about going back to old video games that we feel like they're comfortable, we can play that sort of thing, and so. I'm a huge fan of retro arcade games in general. I'm a big fan of the program MAME, the multi-arcade machine emulator, which you can get for free, and you can download all the games. If you go to places of sketchy provenance, you can find all the games and download them and fire up all the
old... This is a sketchy provenance, chapter 22 in Tom's book, sorry.
Exactly. But the days of like, oh, I'm going to download this game, then that game, we're done. Because you just jump on, like a torrent, and you just get like, all the arcade games like ever made, and it's like 300 gigabytes of like 35,000 arcade games. You're like, okay, here we go. And so periodically I would go through these and I'll just run through them. Like, all right, I just want to try to at least understand what all these things are. And you filter them out. Like, all right, here are all the games that, are like clearly like knockoffs of each other, that sort of thing, where you go through them by year or whatever. And so I've played a lot of really seriously, totally crap arcade games over the years. As I've just, fire it up, play one round, like, it's terrible. There's a reason why I don't know about it and move on. But there is one game that I found that is really, honestly, I really feel ashamed to have even played it, because here's the thing. I like the game. It's a good game with very seriously questionable content. And the game I'm talking about is, all right, well, first I'm going to start by saying, if you remember, there was a game in the 80s called
Kicks.
No,
like caveats. No.
This isn't a caveat. This is context. There's a game called Kicks, KIX, right? And it was a trackball game, and you would move your little cursor across the screen, and you try to draw like a little square to capture a piece of territory before like the other stuff on the board knocked you, right? And you had to kind of slowly cover the rest of the board, right? That was the challenge. So this is a game that's like Kicks. It's a series of games called, I can't believe I'm going to say this. It's called Gal's Panic, and it's these like seriously sketchy Japanese like card like basically what you're doing is you're uncovering these like silhouettes of these like anime pinup girls, right, in various states of undress, and it is really cringy and really Japanese and really horrible, and it's like there's no reason why I should even look at these games twice, but Gal's Panic S2 is a really good game. And it's like every once in a while, I'm like, do I want to play this game, or do I want to be found out by my family?
Yeah, someone could come in.
Someone could come in. Exactly. Like, maybe I won't. And it's one of those things. Like, it's
the only way to do nothing else. Nothing.
Throw a hammer through my monitor. Nothing. Stupid computer broke again.
I'm just playing Fine Sweeper.
But that's the thing. But it's like, it's one of those, like, it the game is, it's clearly one of those games, like, you just, it's just, it's meant for you just to chuck, you know, a bazillion hundred yen coins in there just so you can kind of, you know, get these, you know, prurient little, like, you know, quick time events or whatever. But, you know, but from a game standpoint, like, it's actually really extremely difficult to play, but super, super fun. And it's like, I feel bad. Every once in a while I go back to it. I'm like, I just can't go back to this. This game is indicted. Like, I just can't do it. It's just like, it's not like Custer's Revenge level of just like super evil, you know, it's just, you know, it's just racy, you know, is really what it is.
By no, this point. I hear, Bill, they're like, if you go through a lot of those old, like, MAME compilations and stuff like that of all the different arcade games.
Yeah.
You there's quickly come to the conclusion that the Japanese are really, really good at taking a video game and making a softcore porn knockoff of it.
Right. And you're like, dude,
the repression is real.
Yeah. It's like, why couldn't you just make a game that's just the game and like just put it, I don't know, put Godzilla in the background? Why do I have to have this like half naked tennis playing girl in the background? Like, I don't need that, you know, but you're giving it to me anyway, you know?
But like, yeah, all the playability of the game is still there. So you're like, wow, I'm really enjoying this. Like, Kix was a great game. I love that game.
It's a great game. Exactly. It's a great game. So yeah. So Gal's Panic S2 is my Gal's my great guilty pleasure and true video game shame.
So we read Playboy for the stories and articles. We play Gal's Panic 2 for the game mechanics. Is that what
You know what? Look, Chris, I'm not going to reach Shibumi if I don't take the, you know, the hard challenges, right? So
I find it a completely likely story.
I think the challenges are kind of soft,
actually. look, it's part of my Russian heritage, and that's all. I'm not going to apologize for it. That's all I'm going to say about that. So, All right, real quick, lightning round. I know everybody kind of came with some alternates here, so let's just go around the table real quick. And if there are any alternates you brought in case there were duplications, speak now, forever hold your peace. Tom Hespos,
I didn't pick any backups because I knew no one was going to have mine. So
that's okay. That's a valid answer. It's okay.
You were fully
confident of your shame is what you're saying, and that's okay. That's okay.
I will give you one because like this has been like a renaissance now in my household for the past several weeks. Like, I never really enjoyed Beavis and Butthead the first go around. I mean, I did, but like, you know, it wasn't the end all be all that it was for some
of them Beavis
TV generation.
Yeah.
I don't know what possessed me to like introduce it to my kids, but
oh, God. No, that's a mistake.
Love it.
Yeah.
They're bonkers for Beavis and Butthead. And I kept watching all those kids back then who would they appeal, you know, like, why are you like laughing at this guy going
I need TP for my bunghole.
Yeah.
It's funny though.
My Thomas cannot get enough of you know, Beavis doing the, you know,
the cornholio.
Yeah.
That's about right. I want a cappuccino.
when they made a movie, I thought, okay, that's a bridge too far. Like, no one wants who wants to watch a movie of that? Like a TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, you're like, I'm hungover or drunk or both in college. Sure, throw it on. But
I'm not gonna pay real grown up adult money to go outside and watch this in public, you know.
Although honestly, I remember seeing the South Park movie and going into it feeling the same way and coming out of it with my sides hurting.
Same,
So,
I had the same thought, Joe. Yeah.
Chris Cron, any alternates you brought?
Yeah, the gore novels of John Norman. I don't know if you guys know about this guy. He was actually a philosophy professor at Dartmouth, I believe, wrote under the name of John Norman these really almost great John Carter style novels about an earthling taken to another world where, you know, he's equipped to, you know, be a real tough guy. But like as the series increased or progressed, it increasingly became all about the sort of subtext of the whole setting, which was female slavery and how important it was for women to really be fulfilled. And the fourth book in the series is on its own one of my favorite fantasy / sci-fi novels ever, but you know, there's just too much baggage. It's ultimately it becomes horrifying, and I went deep into this series in a self-conscious way, measuring the political will behind it, and it is just increasingly virulent and
Yeah, yeah.
Troubling.
This is this. You said this was by Nick Fuentes. Who wrote this?
Yeah. I've only ever come across two categories of people who with this novel. It's people who've never heard of it, or people who have gone deep into the series and have come to, and basically have learned to regret it. Like, I have gone someplace I should not have gone. Like, I've ventured into forbidden territory because this is problematic as hell, right? And a lot of more
oblivious. And the
there is like a real life gore subculture. People that they've been around since the earliest days of the internet, at least, like that try to live that whole lifestyle.
And they're weird people. They're very weird
deeply
people.
Deeply weird people.
Deeply weird.
Sometimes ignorance is bliss. Yeah.
I am pretty convinced that the gore fan, and it's G-O-R, by the way, it's the gore fandom and the incel communities, those Venn diagrams are pretty close to a circle.
Yeah, there's some major overlap, yeah.
Joe, what are your alternates for this episode?
I name dropped this earlier, but... Casca the Eternal Mercenary were these books that I read when I was younger. And the premise is brilliant. It's this premise of, Christ is crucified, and one of the Roman soldiers who's tasked with stabbing him in the side with his spear is just a grunt. He's just a soldier. He's just the guy who's doing what he's doing. He's following orders. He's like, this detail sucks. It's hot. It's sandy and all this stuff. And who's this Jewish martyr up on the cross? I'm just going to stab him because that's what I'm told to do. And Christ looks down and says, oh, my son, you're just a soldier, a simple soldier, and such you will remain until I return. And he's like, yeah, whatever. But then he turns out to be immortal. He has this blessing / curse from Christ, and he is the eternal mercenary, and he's the soldier. And he has all these adventures all around the world for the next like 2000 years. He's in the Viking world, like as a mercenary. And then he's in, South America, and he's in Vietnam, and he's all over the place. And I was captivated by the conceit when I was a junior high school reader. I went back and reread them recently, and the prose is so awful. It's just bad. It's literally like somebody took Scrabble tiles and threw them at your head. Like, it's just, the writing sucks. And I'm like, how did you take such an awesome idea and throw it in the washing machine alongside an encyclopedia and a dictionary and hope that meaningful writing came out? Like, it's so bad.
But that series was everywhere, though. Like, I remember for a long time, it was like everywhere, you would see it, like it was like kind of the classic like airport book, and people
were
reading it
for them now.
And
when you order them off Amazon, you get them in like the reprinted, like
omnibus.
A guy made this in his basement setting, right? But Barry Sadler, the guy that wrote those books, also wrote The Ballad of the Green Berets. And that's how he made all his money.
Chris Swan, what have you brought as your auxiliary?
William Shakespeare's Star Wars. It's a play on Star Wars in iambic pentameter.
Whoa.
Verily, A New Hope.
It
followed
is so
by
funny.
The Empire Striketh Back and The Jedi Doth Return. It's seriously, it's in Shakespearean English, and it's freaking awesome. It's totally nerdy. And the characters have soliloquies where you like learn a little bit, like they get a little more deep about, okay, maybe that's what it's like to be Darth Vader, what's like to be Luke Skywalker. And even the droids have. I almost went to our drama department at the high school where I work. It was like, you must, like the back of my head, I had this will be a movie where it's like, this is the play you have to put on. They're like,
Alderaan doth be.
Yeah. William Shakespeare's Peaceful Place. Star Wars. And I was like, yes. And it was going to be like this, wonderful, like at the end, it was going to be this amazing thing. Yeah. And it would like get awards. Most of me was like, this is a dumb idea, which is why I didn't bring it up to him. But they're goofy, but they're also earnest.
Yes, yes. I recall going through The Empire Striketh Back, and at one point, like during the Battle of Hoth, it's like when they knock down the one AT-AT, the AT-AT has a line like, "I am slain."
Yes,
it's like, that's,
I love
so
a few.
Fantastic.
I know it.
Covered itself.
The Death Star battle in the first one, right? They like everybody like. Red One through Red Flight, they all come out on stage and they're like X-Wing, like little, and they're like, Right. One of them's like, I am slain. Explosion. And they vanish from the stage.
It's like, how could you? It's like leader of gold.
I can't believe I know. Like, the listeners can't see this. Obviously, I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt. I'm like, yeah. I consider myself a Star Wars guy, and I've never heard of this. I love it.
It's outstanding. It is so good.
It is. They're a lot of fun. And yeah. I mean, like I said, it's goofy, just the concept, but
yeah,
he wrote them seriously and they're earnest. And that's something to the story. So,
So my auxiliary is from the movies, which is I actually like the inclusion of midichlorians in episode one. And I know it's a bold thing, and I get crazy looks every time.
This isn't a guilty pleasure thing. This is like a headcanon hand grenade. What really?
You know what?
22. You're going to throw in, I think midichlorians were a real thing and a good idea. That's where
I think
there
were. Yeah. And here's the reason why. When I first saw that, I was like, ew. I was like, you can't quantify the force. It's so out of, like Lucas lost the plot of his own story. What the hell? But over time, I'm like, you know what? That for me, that actually worked as a great indicator of just how far afield the Jedi Order had become, where they had actually grown so confident in their position that they actually, they aspire to turn the force into a science. And for me, when I look back at these movies, I'm like, you know what, that the notion of midichlorians, the way it gets mentioned in episode one and never mentioned ever again, for me, you know, I don't think it was intended as such, but in my head canon, it presages this, how the Jedi Order is really primed for a fall. And so it is, I think, bad writing that to me serves a good purpose, and I am therefore grateful for it. And I like to go back to it, and I will defend midichlorians in episode one. So that's
if you haven't seen Red Letter Media's 7-part review of The Phantom Menace, which is totally not safe for work.
I'm sure it's angry.
So
watch. No, it's
like three times
Star
the length
Wars,
of the movie.
The Phantom Menace is the most disappointing thing since my son. That's the voice of, and then you get a picture of a mugshot of this loser and that's the tamest thing.
Yeah.
But it completely deconstructs the whole damn thing. It's not somebody ranting at a screen. It's
it's
like clips from the movie, interviews with people. Go watch that and then come back and tell me what you think of midichlorians.
Well, before we wrap up this sordid affair, a final thought. When we did our first Guilty Pleasures episode, I talked about the concept of bad wrong fun and how it's okay to love what you love no matter what other people think of it. And that's still true, and it always will be. This podcast began as a COVID-19 lockdown project, and we recorded our first Guilty Pleasures episode before the pandemic was even a year old. So it figures that when we initially had this discussion, we could have overlooked one Guilty Pleasure that ended up being as impactful as it was insipid. And I am talking, of course, about the Netflix true crime documentary, Tiger King. Now, I'm not going to describe Tiger King to you because you already know all about it. And if you don't, I'm sure you will shortly. The point is, this Grand Guignol tale of big cat breeding, murder for hire, and American eccentricity at its most scabrous dropped at a time when most everybody was on lockdown and needed something, anything to distract from this silent apocalypse that was happening all around. And Tiger King was just that. And for a time, it was all anybody could talk about. We were united by our shameful love of this story that really is far more grotesque than it pretends to be. However difficult our lives may have been under lockdown, at least we weren't in jail for trying to kill some daffy leopard-printed millionaire in Florida. Now, social psychologists point to shared collective experience as a fundamental means to surviving a societal trauma like COVID-19, where suddenly everyone was grieving, but they didn't know what they were grieving or why. It was our sense of normalcy, our sense of certainty. And bereft of that, we felt bereft from each other and bereft even from ourselves. Strangely, a grimy tale about Joe Exotic brought people together when they needed it most. We probably would have enjoyed it just as much had there been no pandemic, but the degree to which Tiger King impacted folks far more than it ever intended to speaks to the magical properties of art and entertainment and how it really doesn't matter what brings us joy or where we find wonder. What matters is that we find it. Most times it'll just get us through the day, but sometimes it might actually help to save our lives. This has been Moments of Truth. On behalf of myself, Tom, Chris, and Chris, thanks for listening. Catch you next time. Moments of Truth is hosted by Bill Coffin, Chris Crenshaw, Tom Hespos, and Joe Pace. This podcast is edited by Derek Eisenhart. The Moments of Truth theme is a mashup of The Claremont by Flash Fluherty and a little help from a Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. For more Moments of Truth, Be sure to subscribe to this show wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check us out on YouTube or at momentsoftruth.show. And now, a little crass commercialism. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Dollars.
When Andy Chester loses his young wife Lisa to breast cancer, he finds himself on a grief journey with no certain destination. As he confronts his greatest fears about death, Andy must reckon with the possibility that there may be no life after Lisa. Read After Lisa, the new novel by best-selling author Joe Pace, available now on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
Susie Faulkner has fought against the darkness her whole life, but will her skills be enough against her evil equal? Never Back Down, number 3 in the Faulkner Family Thriller Series by Christopher Swan, available now.
Experience 53 of the greatest weird fiction short stories ever published by Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, Gray Lespina, Ambrose Bierce, and many more in Tales from the Outer Canon, a new weird fiction anthology edited by Bill Coffin. Get Tales from the Outer Canon today on Amazon or for free on archive.org. The Yellow King demands it.